Welcome to All the Things with Monique Dusson from the Center for Biblical Unity and Theology Mom, Krista Bontrager. And now, here's Krista and Monique.
Hello and happy Saturday night. Welcome to All the Things. This is the show where we talk about all the things related to God, the Bible, and real life. I am Krista Bontrager, also known as Theology Mom, and I was gone last week visiting my friend in Texas, and Monique had to do the show by herself, and this week Monique's gone, so now I have to do the show by myself, but I have a very awesome guest, and we will hear from Monique at the end of the show. We have a short segment to play for you with her and I, so no fear, she will be here, and we are live. Tonight, I want to say thank you to our moderators, Sylvia and Alicia, for helping us out tonight on the stream. So make sure, oh, I see Jen's there too. Okay, great. So make sure to say hello to us. Make sure to hit the thumbs up. We really need you to interact with things. The more that you interact with the show, that helps boost the algorithms. And so you want to be doing that. It's just a free and great way to be able to support the show. Also, make sure that you are subscribed to the digital newsletter for All the Things. You can just go to allthethingsshow.com and subscribe to the newsletter, and then you'll receive an update, always knowing what's coming up on the show, when we're going to be live, all that fun stuff. Now, I have a big announcement, and we'll probably continue to announce this, but we just found out yesterday our friend Natasha Crane texted us later in the day and said, hey, did you know that your book is now on pre-sale on Amazon? And we said, no, we had no idea. So Bob just pulled it up. There it is, with the new cover from Harvest House, Walking in Unity, Biblical Answers to Questions on Race and Racism. Now, here's what we need you to do. Y'all, it is coming out October 15th from Harvest House. What we need you to do is go pre-order it. I know a lot of you pre-ordered the previous version from Salem, and all of those orders got canceled, and Salem was in some issues, and so Harvest House picked up the book. So we need you to do those pre-orders again, and you will get the book when it drops in mid-October. But it's really, really helpful when we have pre-orders because it lets the publisher know, it lets the algorithms know, it lets Amazon know that you like this kind of content and that you want to put your money into investing in content that is of a more biblically faithful, conservative, whatever you want to call it, perspective. And when the whole world is kind of tilting progressive, we can't just sit by and complain. We have to be willing to support alternatives. And part of that, a big part of that, is participating in the economic system and putting up money. And that is just how things work in the real world. So we want to invite you to go to Amazon right now, go pre-order the book. And if you are watching this on replay, please continue to comment and like the stream wherever you're watching it and pre-order the book as well. Okay, our topic for tonight, the big question is, are we at the start of World War III? Are we on the brink? Has it already started? Lots of chatter this week on Twitter with World War III talk. And so I know that a lot of you are not on social media anymore because you're like, I can't with the crazy. I don't speak this version of crazy. I don't want to participate in all of the depressing news, okay? So Monique and I do the hard work so you don't have to. We read all the depressing stuff and kind of sift through it and decide like, hey, I think this is a conversation people probably should want to have a take on and be a little bit informed about. So we're going to talk about this topic. Last fall, we did a series of discussions that were triggered by the war in Israel that started on October 7th. We had our friend Kevin Briggins on to do a family meeting over on the Center for Biblical Unity YouTube. And that was a great conversation. We got a lot of awesome feedback about that discussion. Then I went on my Theology Mom channel to do some additional teachings on how to think about Judaism, the relationship between Jews and Israel, and also did a three-part series on the history of Israel. Because if you're going to understand the Palestinians and the conflict between Gaza and Israel, you're going to have to understand some history. And so I kind of did a little bit of a crash course there on the history of Israel. I have in the pipeline a podcast with my friend Callie Mitchell, where we're going to be doing a deep dive into the term anti-Semitism and the whole Christ is King controversy. So you want to make sure that you are signed up for our digital newsletter so you won't miss out on that content. But I have all of the present teachings gathered on the Theology Mom YouTube channel. You can just go to Theology Mom on YouTube, go to the playlist section. There's an entire playlist called Judaism, Israel, and the Middle East Conflict. And I've put all of the teachings there, the discussions across all our platforms are on one playlist. So you can go check that out. But it's a complicated topic with a lot of different features to it. And so it has taken a lot of conversations. I remember in that first discussion with Kevin way back in early October, I knew zero. Pretty much everything he told us on that stream was new information for me. I knew absolutely nothing about the history of Israel, the complexities of the conflict, and the peace accords and all the attempts of creating a two-state solution. I knew none of that. And so if you want to get up to speed, that will be a resource for you. So tonight, we've asked our friend Kevin to come back on. Monique helped me put these questions together, so she has weighed in on this as well. But he's going to give us an update to what's happening in Israel. A lot of recent events happening. Last Sunday, my friend Callie, who lives in Jerusalem, was texting me about drones coming her direction. Now Israel has retaliated. What does it all mean? There's chatter of Israel retaliating against other countries. What about Russia? What about China? Is that going to pull us into World War III? So we're going to try to tackle that from a Christian perspective tonight. So if you're watching live, make sure to put your questions in the comments. That will help other people as well, because you're probably not the only person with that question. Toward the end of the show, we're going to be talking about some updates related to Title IX. Monique and I did a live stream this morning, and we'll be sharing that with you toward the end of the show as a second segment. Okay, with that, I'll bring on our friend Kevin Briggins to the show. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Yes. Well, it's gonna be a good conversation to good time to kind of do an update and see how things have progressed. Maybe start off by telling us about your background and what kind of qualifies you to make some comments and have some informed takes on the events in the Middle East.
Yeah, so I've had a 22-year career focused on the Middle East as an analyst. I used to teach certain classes that dealt with Middle Eastern culture, and have an undergraduate degree in Middle Eastern studies. So this part of the world has been a heavy focus for me the last 20 years. So that's kind of my background and what kind of gives me some perspective to speak on some of these things.
Very good. And we want to emphasize that all your opinions are your own, and that you're not here to represent any other entity other than yourself sitting in your house. Absolutely. With your microphone.
Yes.
So, well, last fall, as I mentioned, we did a discussion in October about the start of the war in Israel. What happened? Maybe just get us a little bit caught up to speed. Is what did happen in Israel last October? And what has the fighting been over all of these months? Because there's still a war going on in Israel.
Yes. So for those who don't remember, who aren't aware, October 7th of last year, Hamas, which is the government in Gaza, and they're also a terrorist group, came over, got through Israel's border security, came over and massacred around 1,400 Israeli citizens and took about 250 citizens hostage back into Gaza. And that generated this response, this war that we've seen basically ever since October 7th that's happened in that region. It's broadened, it's escalated right now, as we've talked about Iran coming into it now. But that is kind of the situation of Israel got hit with a major, major terrorist attack on its citizens. And also, like I said, kidnapped some of their citizens. And so this is Israel's ongoing response to that October 7th attack.
Yeah, and so they started off with kind of an air campaign, and then that eventually evolved into a ground campaign of going into Gaza. And it has become increasingly complicated. So maybe just something basic is, what is your understanding of Israel's goals in the war? Like, how would they know when it's over?
Oh, yeah. So Israel has one primary goal, and they've been very vocal about that, and that is the to destroy Hamas. So Hamas is no longer the government of Gaza, and they're no longer a credible, formidable organization or threat to Israel. This is all about security for Israel. The one thing that I don't think Hamas really thought about hard enough was the fact that what kept Israel at bay was the fact that Israel felt its security was good enough, right? Once they lost the confidence in that security, they determined they can no longer live next door to a terrorist organization. And so they are doing everything in their power to root out the organization. Now, I know there's a situation in terms of bringing back hostages, and Israel wants to bring back every hostage. But because Israel deals with these things so often, you go back to the 1970s, you go back to like the hijackings of planes and taking their citizens and the Olympic murders and all of those types of things. Israel has a very strong policy. They will not be, you're not going to use their own citizens as bargaining chips. They're going to come in to take you out. They hope they can get their citizens back in the process. That's kind of how they go about these things. They're not going to tiptoe around because they might lose some people. They know they're going to lose people. That's just the nature of dealing with Islamic terrorist organizations. That's just the reality of being an Israeli citizen, is that they're going to come in to rescue you. That's what they want to do, but they're going to take out the enemy. And so that's number one. So that's why you've seen such a heavy-handed response to this Hamas thing. They're going to take out Hamas, and along the way, they hope to get their citizens back.
I think it's important for people to understand that point, because there would be some that would maybe put the hostages first and say, like, at all costs, we need to rescue these people and keep them alive. Now, early in the war, I think it was in November, they did pause the fighting, the bombing, for 5 or 6 days, and were able to negotiate release of most of the women and children, from what I understand. And there are a few hostages that are from other countries. From what I understand, there's a few Americans among the hostages. So Israel did pause the fighting for a little while to rescue some of the most vulnerable, but they are not going to engage in a ceasefire for the sake of saving some hostages. Because if I understand from a military standpoint, the minute that you do that, then you have monetized your citizens, and then the enemy will just continue to kidnap your citizens, hold them hostage until you comply with whatever it is that they want. And so Israel will not, essentially monetize its citizens. It is willing to allow those hostages to die if necessary for the greater good of securing the nation and achieving the goal of eliminating Hamas. Am I on the right track there?
Absolutely. I mean, even in the United States, we have a similar policy, because the minute you start to negotiate with terrorists that kidnap your citizens, you put every other citizen at risk, because once they know it's successful and it works, they'll keep doing it. So you have to make it a deterrent to where they don't view kidnapping your citizens as a viable goal or plan.
Okay.
And so, yeah, and that's really, like, that's the United States strategy as well.
Now, in your opinion, I would like to hear from you. You know, we're about, I don't know, 7 or so months into this. As a non-military person, I'm a skeptic that it's possible to eradicate Hamas, because, as you said, Hamas is not just a terrorist organization. It is also the government structure that was elected some time ago. I mean, it's been in place for a while. I don't know, like maybe 15 years or so.
Yeah, 2006, I believe.
Yeah,
is when they wrote it.
And so how do you erase the ideology of Hamas without wiping out a massive part of the population? Because I think one of the unanswered questions for me in my own research is, what percentage of the citizens of Gaza support Hamas? And, you know, what's that Venn diagram of, because if you have a large number of citizens supporting the ideology, how do you wipe it out? I don't know if Israel's goal is realistic. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah. So I would say this, if there was an election today in Gaza or the West Bank, Hamas would win those elections. And I say today, prior to October 7, polls show that Hamas would win an election in either Palestinian-controlled territory. And that is why the Palestinian Authority did not allow elections in the West Bank, because the data was showing that Hamas would win that election. And so Hamas is popular. Like, it's not everyone, but they are popular in the Palestinian territories. In terms of Israel, they cannot wipe out all hatred against them. But what they can do is neutralize Hamas from being an actual operational threat to them and their citizens, right? They can take out their tunnels. They can take out the weapons. They can, you know, take out their leadership. They can really decimate them as an organization, to where they can't operate and be a threat. Because that plan or that operation on October 7th took a lot of planning, a lot of coordination. A lot was behind that. If you can disrupt that, you can be successful. It's kind of the United States, what our plan was after 9/11 with Al-Qaeda. There's a reason we haven't had another attack on the homeland, because once you don't give them safe haven, once they can't operate freely, you really disrupt their ability to pull out large-scale attacks. And so that is really what Israel's goal is. Israel knows they can't force the people in Palestinian-controlled territories to not hate them. They hate them already, you know, when they weren't doing anything. And so, that what is next after this is going to be a big question mark for the whole international community. Like, how do you rebuild Gaza? Who controls Gaza? And how does it become a viable place where people can live and flourish and not a terrorist, you know, safe haven? And so that's going to be the hard part. To me, the war is the easy part. It is the, how do you move forward? Because the whole two-state solution thing is, that's gone. That is never going to work. You have to have two sides that want that. And right now you just don't. And so what the future is, that's what the UN and the international community has got to come in and just really get involved and try to make Gaza some place that is sustainable and livable, and not just a place where Hamas operates and fires rockets, you know.
I think the challenge is that it's going to be challenging to find local leadership that people will respect in Gaza, but who are willing to engage in a project of democracy, of a level of, I don't know what to call it, like,
civility
and order and justice. And,
yes.
You know, there are cultural challenges there, I think. I want to be careful at the same time that, you know, we don't completely disparage the citizens of Gaza. I'm sure that with any population, there are people with all kinds of views, and there are probably peaceful people who live in Gaza, and yet their life has been so disrupted. I mean, because Hamas has set up, Hamas has basically made Gaza into a quasi-military base. And they have embedded these tunnels under people's homes, under schools, under hospitals. And so they've turned what normally you have clear military targets are now mixed up with human targets and part of civilized society. And so much of Gaza is now just rubble. I mean, even though Israel has tried to only target military things, it's nearly impossible because of
it is absolutely impossible
how Hamas has rigged the system. And so the optics of that look very bad. And when we see these pictures from Gaza where it's just piles and piles of rubble, the way of life of the citizens of Gaza has at minimum been disrupted, and for many it has been traumatic and potentially destroyed. And
yes,
it's heartbreaking, and war is very difficult and messy, but in this particular situation it's very hard because the civilian and the military is just all interconnected.
Yes. War is the epitome of, to me, the ultimate expression of the fall, right? It is a result of the ultimate depravity of man, even when it's necessary, right? It just shows what we're capable of to each other. Like I say, even when it's necessary. But yeah, you're right. It is, I mean, the United States went through it in Iraq and Afghanistan. Whenever you're fighting a non-conventional force, meaning that you're not fighting an army with tanks and airplanes and with uniforms on, you're fighting people wearing regular clothes that are carrying rifles. They're hiding, you know, rockets and rocket launchers in schools and homes and mosques. And yeah, it's hard to target legitimate targets without it also being conflicted with civilian life. But it's one of those things of you really don't have a choice because that's what they're giving you. But they're also doing it because at the end of the day, it is about propaganda, right? At the end of the day, they want you to hit that hospital. They want you to hit that school because they're going to have their people on Twitter tweeting out, oh, look what, you know, Israel did. They're going to have, you know, people in certain governments condemning the attack or the strike and all of these types of things. But they're not going to tell you that, well, that's where they had militants and they were firing from that school or that mosque or, you know. And so
The optics look very bad.
The optics look bad. And that is really, that's Israel's toughest challenge is winning the court of public opinion, right? Because this is all simply a game of propaganda because Hamas knows that's their only chance of survival is to make the propaganda and the optics look so bad that the international community and the gullible people around the world say, oh no, look at the poor, you know, Palestinians, look what's happening. We got to call a ceasefire. Or, you know, that's the only way they survive, is to make it look so bad to where the international community forces Israel to stop.
What would be your brief, argument against a ceasefire? Because there's been a lot of conversations. I don't know what your position is about a ceasefire. Do you see pros and cons to that?
A ceasefire is really pointless. It has no end goal, because that's not a solution to the war. It's simply a delay. You're simply delaying it. That's not a solution. Either you're delaying it a week or two, or you're delaying it 6 months or a year. Eventually, this fight has to happen. This war has to happen. These two sides cannot coexist next to each other. And so when people talk about a ceasefire, what's their end goal? Because I can tell you right now, October 6th is never going to happen again. You know, the attack was on October 7th. October 6th, Israel felt safe and secure with their defenses and that they could live next door to Hamas.
And they were in a ceasefire on October 6th.
Yeah, they were in a ceasefire. Like, that's what I want to harp on. Everything that is happening today is the result of Hamas's actions. There was peace. There was a ceasefire. Hamas is the one who attacked Israel, and not just attacked Israel, went after and murdered, you know, 1,400 civilians, men, women, children, in some of the most brutal ways possible, and then put it on social policy, right? This is a very, very brutal group who doesn't... One thing in the West, because we have a Judeo-Christian kind of foundation and worldview, we can be very, you know, sympathetic to suffering and all of these things. But one of the mistakes we often make is we think everybody is just like us, right? We don't understand the other parts of the world are different. In the Middle East, the only thing that is respected is strength, right? That is why there are certain nations, because you mentioned about, you know, democracy and things like that in Gaza. My first thought was democracy might not be the best thing. Sometimes a strong dictator that can keep the peace is the best thing. But that sounds very, you know, so from a Western standpoint, that sounds crazy. But there are times where everyone isn't ready for democracy. Every, you know, civilization, a country, a nation isn't ready for that. Gaza clearly wasn't, because look what they elected. They elected Hamas. And look what the results are. And so, it's a very, very difficult situation. And the end goal, or the how do you come out the other side, isn't as always as clear as we would like it to be. Sometimes it's going to be messy.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a little break here and hear from our friends at the Unshaken Conference, and we will be right back in 1 minute.
Unshaken 2024 is coming. Join three of the most influential voices in cultural apologetics, Natasha Crane, Frank Turek, and Elisa Childers, as they equip Christians to live for Jesus in a world increasingly at odds with biblical Christianity. At Unshaken, you will join hundreds of others who are seeking to navigate the intersection of societal pressure and biblical truth, covering topics such as deconstruction, social justice, sexuality, and many more. Unshaken will teach you what the Bible has already said about the social issues we face today, and equip you to stand firm in God's truth. The Unshaken Conference will be visiting Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Buffalo, New York, and Austin, Texas in 2024. For details and tickets, visit unshakenconference.com and use code FRIEND20 to get 20% off your ticket price. Join us this year for an experience that will embolden and encourage your faith. That's code FRIEND20 at unshakenconference.com. We'll see you there.
Okay, and we will be in Pittsburgh, which is the next Unshaken Conference. So come by the table and see us. We would love to meet you. we haven't really done any events in Pittsburgh. So we're curious, who's there? Who's in the family that's in the Pittsburgh area? Come out to the Unshaken Conference. Just a one-day event. Bring your teenagers, bring your friends, bring your enemies, and enjoy some really great talks. Okay, I'm going to look through the comments. Oh, there's a lot of comments on YouTube. Awesome. I'm going to look through those. I want to ask you, Kevin. All right, let's start turning our attention to what's been happening in the last week. I heard that Iran sent like 100 or so drones toward Israel. I don't think I even really understand what a drone is, but has Iran been involved all along? Was this out of the blue? Set some context for that event for me.
Yeah. So one thing people need to understand is that from October 7th to the day, this has been a war between Israel and Iran. Iran, you know, funded, planned, helped coordinate that October 7th attack. So what Iran does, they have what we call proxy groups. They have these terrorist groups that they support, and they act on behalf of Iran. They provide them with weapons, they provide them with training, and they give them orders on like what to do and what to attack. And so you have Hamas over in Gaza, you have Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria and Iraq, you have the Houthis in Yemen, and all of these are just Iranian proxy groups that they control. And so when you hear about Saudi Arabia fighting the Houthis in Yemen, that is Saudi Arabia fighting Iran, right? And so Iran controls these groups, and it's almost a way for Iran to kind of say their hands are off, but at the same time, they're the ones who are orchestrating everything.
So Saudi Arabia then isn't at war with Israel. It's the Houthis who are financed by Iran who are then trying to bomb Israel. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing got... It's complicated because you got to remember when people think, okay, well, everybody in the Middle East hates Israel. Well, it might be true to a degree, but Israel has had, you know, better relations. You had the Abraham Accords and things like that. But you also can't forget the Sunni Shia divide, right? Iran is the Shias, right? Shia Islam. Almost every other nation in the Middle East are Sunnis. Right. And so Saudi Arabia, for instance, that's Sunni. And so Jordan is Sunni. And so, yeah, there's a so those countries themselves have conflict with Iran. It's almost like a three-way relationship kind of deal going on here of who's friends with who.
Okay.
And who do you not like more? That's almost how it is today. But yeah, and so Iran has been involved with this from the beginning. When you look at what's happening in Syria, when you look at what's happening in Yemen, when you look at what's happening in Lebanon, Gaza, it's all Iran. And that's why even the United States told Iran, hey, if we get attacked by one of these groups, we're going to blame you. Because we know they're the ones that are behind it, right? So if the Houthis off the coast of Yemen strike one of our ships, we're not just going to respond and hit this little group. No, we're going to blame Iran for it.
Okay.
Because they're the ones financing it. They're the ones who are giving orders. And that's what, and so to tie this all to what's currently happening, that is why Israel struck the target they did in Syria, which was the Iranian consulate, right? So the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, that is Iran's elite military force, but they're also the ones that kind of like, they handle all of these groups and give them money and training and orders, right? And so Israel struck the Iranian consulate in Syria and killed 3 or 4 high-ranking IRGC officers. And that's why Iran, for the first time, did not hide behind their proxies and actually tries to strike Israel directly. because they knew they had to some degree, to save face. And the number wasn't 100. It was actually, they fired over like 300 drones, ballistic missiles, and cruise missiles.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it was actually 300 total that they fired at Israel. And between Israel and the United States, 99% of those were shot down. So they fired 300 things that were completely ineffective.
In that effort, then, I know Israel has something called the Iron Dome, which it,
yes.
I perceive to be some kind of strategic missile shield that shoots things down before they hit Israel. And the reason still people like my friend Callie Mitchell has to go inside the bunker is because shrapnel does fall, and the shrapnel can sometimes injure people depending on where it falls. But they have a pretty effective missile system to shoot these things down. So although 300 things were coming at them, it was basically neutralized.
Yes. Along with the United States, we helped shoot some things down as well.
Okay.
But that's one thing I want to point at too. People need to understand the military capability of the West versus the rest of the world is a huge gap. And that was one of the prime examples that shows it. They fired 300 rockets, drones, and cruise missiles. And they had a 1% effective rate. And not even effective. 1% got through Western defenses. And so that just shows you the really gap between Iran and Israel. And so that's why a lot of this talk, I know we're going to get into it about World War III, I'm not going to call it silly, no, it is silly to me, but it's more behind it than just people being fearful of World War III happening. That is really, the gist of what's going on in terms of why Israel struck Syria, hit an Iranian target in Syria, why Iran felt the need to respond to save face. And then Israel, even though Iran's attack was completely unsuccessful, Israel, to save face, also said, we're going to retaliate and respond to this attack. And then they fired, I think it was one or two missiles and hit an airbase or something. But it's a lot more show than it is substance.
Go ahead. So prior to October 7th, because of the Abraham Accords, which, if I'm remembering correctly, was something under the Trump administration, they kind of brought a level of stability to the surrounding nations around Israel. And that was a point that you had mentioned to me, last fall, is that, look, like the Abraham Accords, Israel was pretty much living at peace with Jordan and Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. And, there was a lot of stability. Egypt, even though they have a border with Egypt and things were contentious in the 70s, since Anwar Sadat and those peace accords under the Carter administration, Egypt has stayed pretty stable. And so there was more stability than we may have been aware of. But what's happening is these terrorist groups that live inside of these countries, although their governments have formal peace agreements under the Abraham Accords, these terrorist groups that are funded by Iran are just constantly stirring up trouble.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Because it's the whole from the river to the sea, Palestine, that whole issue about a Palestinian state, or I'll tell you about it. It's not even so much about a Palestinian state, because that never existed, as it is about a Jewish state not existing.
That's correct.
Right.
And that's something people have to understand, this whole, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. What that statement is actually a Jewish annihilation statement of that they want all of the territory of Israel for Arabs, and they do not want Jewish people living there. And yes, that is what that saying means. And if people want details about that, the conversation I did with Callie last fall is kind of, she went into great detail on the history of all of that and where that saying comes from. And we covered all of that. I want to do a few comments here, Kevin, and then we'll do a few more questions. But people are just have a lot of questions. One of them, I'm going to go to Jennifer Shotwell. She's watching us in Hawaii. She says, Saudi Arabia also cooperated to let Israel defend themselves from further areas in Yemen, I believe. And there's someone else was asking about with Saudi Arabia and Jordan, were other countries kind of in cooperation with Israel's efforts to defend itself?
I'm sure they were. They kind of have to be, especially when you're talking about airspace. If Israel is going to fly, because there are a lot of countries between Israel and Iran, right? And so sometimes, yeah, Israel needs to fly through those countries. And I guess there's debate over whether they allow Israel to or whether Israel just does it and there's nothing they can do about it. But it's one of those things, the enemy of my enemy is my friend type deal. Those countries are not friends with Iran. Those are Sunni nations. Even if they sympathize with the Palestinian issue, those are still Sunni nations that have an issue with a Shia country in Iran. Okay. Because Iran has ambitions of controlling the region. So all of those countries, even though they're Sunni-led countries, they all have Shias that live in those countries that that Iran likes to instigate and stir up. And, you know, all those countries are worried about a Shia rebellion in their own country if the Ayatollah calls for it. And so they are no friends to Iran. And so because of that whole Shia-Sunni divide. And so, yeah, even though they may not agree totally with some of the stuff, even though they may be sympathetic to the Palestinian cause or plight, they're not necessarily going to side with Iran over Israel in a lot of these situations because they have issues with Iran as well.
Susanna's asking, if Israel did not have the Iron Dome, how would this conflict in Gaza be different with Iran? Like, how would that look?
Yeah, I would just go back to the first Gulf War and what happened. When Saddam was very smart. And so what he was trying to do was rally the Arab world to his cause. And so by doing so, he started attacking Israel, hoping it would bring Israel into the fight and it would rally the Middle East to come to his aid. What we did to stop Israel from getting involved was we gave them Patriot missiles. So we gave Israel an air defense system. And this was before they had the Iron Dome. So if they did not have the Iron Dome today, I believe that we would supply them with air defenses to defend themselves. Because that's what we did in the first Gulf War in the early 90s.
Now, America's been pretty involved in the war in supporting Israel. But I brought this out in my teaching series, is that we also have to understand our tax dollars fund the UN. And the UN funds an entity called UNRWA. And UNRWA is, allegedly, it runs schools and humanitarian aid in Gaza. But there's a lot of, Kevin's doing air quotes around the word allegedly, because there's a lot of conversation, shall we say, about UNRWA's questionable activities and who they employ that seem to be fairly sympathetic to Hamas and sometimes adjacent to Hamas. And so there is a way in which our country is funding both sides of this war. We also seem to have given Iran some money. And so aren't we sort of participating in the conflict from that perspective, it's a little confusing to me what we did to Iran.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things I was talking about when I said we make these assumptions that everyone is just like us. And we don't understand that the only thing they respect is strength. And that's why Trump was so successful, because he showed a sense of strength. And there's also somewhat unpredictability. You know, they didn't know what he would do. And so a lot of times that led them to not do anything because they weren't quite sure how the United States would respond. But with the current administration, they already know how the current administration is going to respond. It's not doing much. And so, for instance, given Iran releasing their funds to give them more money, that was the $6 billion. People warned, hey, if you release this money, you're simply going to be funding their, basically all their shenanigans in the Middle East. But we did it because we think that we can get people to cooperate with us if we just simply give them money. And that's just not the case. And then even with the UN, now we say allegedly, but we've determined we will not fund any more. UNRWA is not getting any more UN funding.
They've temporarily suspended that. That's correct.
Yes.
But that wasn't until well after the war started.
Yeah, when it finally came out of what they were actually doing. And so, yeah, it to a degree, because we're naive, because of a lot of times, it's really a lot of times it's the very left and progressive of us that are sympathetic to all of these causes. You end up with people who, you know, want to be humanitarian, and they have this heartfelt need for, you know, the people of Gaza, and they go in there and they end up siding with groups like Hamas because they think Hamas, they think they're freedom fighters, right? You know, we talked about last time the way BLM and all these other organizations were supporting Hamas, not just Palestinian, they were actually supporting Hamas. And so once we understand that, yeah, I'm not surprised that there are organizations that claim to be humanitarian, but are really helping to aid a group like Hamas, who they view as freedom fighters against oppression.
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah. So at the end of the day, indirectly or unintentionally, yes, we are somewhat guilty of funding both sides of this.
So let's get back into the World War III question, because some of the chatter I've been seeing on Twitter this past week, especially with the attack of the drones toward Israel and then Israel's retaliation, you know, people are commenting this is World War III and Russia's going to get drawn in. China could potentially be drawn in. And I saw a comment that you made on Twitter, and this is what gave me the idea of the show. You said, please stop. Please stop with the World War III talk.
I didn't know you thought that.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I got to talk to Kevin, like, to find out, you know, why he's saying this. Because if I read all the tweets on social media, the world is ending next week. The dispensationalists are predicting the rapture. And we're going to have the whole thing just kind of wrapped up very soon.
Yes. So even conservative political commentators that I respect and like and follow have been getting on my nerves with this World War III thing. This is what I will say, and I say it's more behind it. The calls, all of these people saying this is going to be World War III, it is is the exact opposite or the same side of the different side of the same coin of the people who keep shouting about genocide, right? They're both intended to shape public opinion a certain way, right? There's no genocide happening in Gaza. Nobody actually believes that, right? But you say genocide because you're trying to sway public opinion.
Trying to get people's attention. You're trying to make it sound extreme. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The same thing, the World War III stuff. The reason people are saying that, because they're trying to sway public opinion against U.S. action, right? The Candace Owens of the world. They're the isolationists. They're the, we don't want to give any more money. We don't want to be involved in anything else. So we're going to say things like World War III to shape public opinion so everybody be against this, right? Knowing next time somebody says World War III, ask who's the other side, right? If you got all the Western powers involved, what force is on the other side that can make this a World War III, all right? So you say Russia. Russia is needing Iran's help to help fight against Ukraine. They can't even defeat Ukraine. You think they want to fight the Western powers? No, they really don't. China has their own agenda. China's not giving up or going to war to save Iran. They don't have that type of relationship. And China has their own goals. And they're not going to jeopardize their own goals and plans for Iran and Israel. They don't care. I mean, they'll put out a statement saying, and that's the thing too, Russia and China have put out statements, you know, basically trying to get both sides to have cooler heads and let's, you know, not escalate this. Nobody wants this in terms of a expanded war conflict. China has their own goals. China is a very, they have their eyes on the prize of what they want, and they're not going to jeopardize their goals. And that means getting a war with the United States over Iran. And so there really is no other power or side out there to come to Iran's aid that could start a world war. There's just not two sides like there were in the 1930s and 40s. There's no Germany. There's no Italy. There's no axis of evil there. And from a military standpoint, and that's why I pointed out that Iran firing 300, drones, missiles, and cruise missiles, and 99% of it failed and got shot down. That's the difference in military capability between the West and everybody else to a degree. When you think about, if you put Iran on the same level as Iraq, you know, in the first Gulf War, Iraq had the fourth largest army in the world. Baghdad was the most heavily air defense city in the entire world, and we took them out in 3 weeks, right? Same thing with the second Gulf War, Iraq War, where we went in there. Like, there is such a gap in capability that there just really is no threat for a world war. The only two nations that have, you know, somewhat similar capabilities is Russia and China. But like I said, Russia's having their own issues in Ukraine, and China's just has their own agenda. There is no formidable agenda that draws all of them together that can lead to a world war. Nobody wants that.
So your sense of it is a little bit more optimistic, you know, like because the stuff that I'm reading on social media, I mean, it's pretty doom and gloom. You're helping me feel a little bit.
It is doom and gloom, but nobody can paint the picture of how we get there.
Okay.
Right? How do we get there? There's not a whole lot of roadmaps to get there. And even with this Iran Israel thing, it's very tit for tat, right? They're not mobilizing to go to war with each other. It is a lot of rhetoric. It is a lot of saving face. It's a game. It is a game of public opinion. Everybody wants to look strong for their people. And, you know, the evil Zionists will pay. Iran.
It's a lot of rhetoric. It's a strong word.
Yeah, it's just rhetoric. That's all it is.
Okay.
You know?
Well, let me ask you this question, because I think that, you know, you mentioned Candace Owens. She was on Tucker Carlson recently. I think that there is a division that's happening currently among conservatives of, you know, how involved should we be in wars overseas, and a lot of talk about the military industrial complex, lots of talk about certain businesses that benefit from us being in a constant state of war because they provide military supplies and meals and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And, you know, I think, and I would be curious as to what your thoughts are, that our involvement overseas in other conflicts can be a matter of discussion and opinion among Christians. I don't immediately see it as like we have a core tenet of our worldview at stake here. Like, this is an issue where I think Christians can have a lively discussion. I don't think we should part company necessarily with one another about the degrees to which we are involved in overseas conflict. We can debate the wisdom of that, or whether we can afford it, or has anyone ever noticed the current deficit in our country, or how we're printing all of this pretend money? Like, we can debate all of those things, but you know, I think that it's not something that should be, I don't see anything immediately core at stake in the faith. Do you see something that I don't? I'd be curious as to what your thoughts are.
Yeah, so two things can be true. The military-industrial complex is a thing. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that they're responsible orchestrating all things in the world either, right? You almost have what James Lindsay called the woke right, right? Where everything is the result and actions of a system, right? And so people like Candace Owens, she's starting from a standpoint of this is the result of the military industrial complex, just because, yeah, money will be involved. They will benefit. But she's therefore concluded that then therefore all of this stuff is just happening because of the military industrial complex, even though she has nothing to back that up with. And so, yeah, I think what we're dealing with is the woke right, because everything is simply a conspiracy theory that is being controlled by a larger system, right? And so I don't see anything from a Christian standpoint. I mean, you have to judge everything in its own context. Like, this war with between Israel and Hamas, that has nothing to do with anything else, right? And so you have to judge that by its own merit. Same thing with Ukraine and Russia. But a lot of it too is some of it is reactionary to globalism, right? This hardcore to not just America first, but America only type mindset. It is it's basically a overcorrection to globalism and the World Economic Forum and all of those things, World Health Organization. But at the same time, you have basically these two sides that are, that says an overcorrection to globalism. And people have, they're starting from the standpoint of, I don't want to be involved in anything. And then that is shaping how they're viewing these conflicts. They're not coming at it from an objective standpoint. They're coming from the end point that they want, which is we're not involved. And then they're drawing their conclusions and their rhetoric and their takes based off of that. And that's why Ben Shapiro was so upset with Candace, because she wasn't coming at this honestly. She was coming at this from a standpoint of trying to sway public opinion for us not to be involved. Tucker Carlson did the same thing, right? And so they're not coming at it from an honest perspective. But like I said, from a Christian standpoint, we have to judge each conflict on its own merit. And I think you look at Israel, they got attacked, they're responding, you know. They have a right to respond and defend themselves. War's ugly. War was never meant to be public, first of all. I mean, that's what makes it so tough, is social media and news, 24-hour news and all these things makes what's like the ugliest part of humanity is now broadcast publicly.
And I don't think that a lot of people know. I don't think a lot of people know how wicked humanity really is. And so when it's broadcast on social media, it's a little like, oh my, I don't know if maybe we shouldn't be doing this. But yet, you know, in World War II, before social media, before the internet, things were highly curated in what they were showing the public and creating a narrative of winning and we're defeating the bad guys. But we were bombing We were not just bombing military bases. We were bombing a lot of things for the greater good of getting to the total surrender and defeat of the Nazis. And there were a lot of German civilians who died in that for the greater good.
And nobody screamed genocide.
Yeah. And so we have to be understand that what we are seeing in this war, it is not normal for us to be kind of a voyeur on war. And I think that that is influencing how people think about it. War is actually probably not as deadly now as it was in World War II. Because
we're in your clothes.
Yeah. And so, but we are shocked to hear of the destruction. And, you know, people who are very sensitive have difficulty processing that. And so, we have to really think carefully. And there's a lot of angles to this. Do you think, from your perspective, that America should be involved in this war? Do you see it, that it falls under the ideals of just war theory? And again, this is your opinion. This is something that Christians can debate, but I'm just curious as to what your thoughts are about that.
I mean, there's a reason that we supported Ukraine when Russia invaded them unprovoked. Right. And there's a reason we're supporting Israel when Hamas attacked them unprovoked. Right. You have the right to defend yourself. And there are from a United States standpoint, there are countries that we consider allies and friends that we will help support and defend, whether that is directly or indirectly, like in Ukraine, where we're just giving them, you know, weapons and support and all that type of stuff. Or if it's like a NATO situation where we've actually got to go and fight in defense of someone. But that is, and that's the other part I was going to bring up too, about somewhat the naiveness of it. People don't understand geopolitics, right? They don't understand the life that we live here in the West and the life we live in the United States is largely because of our military presence around the world, right? It is largely because our Navy controls the seas and allows for free trade and free shipping to go through the Persian Gulf and the South China Sea and all these places that are contentious. They are open for trade, and our economic strength comes from the fact that our military controls it. Also, our economic strength comes from the partnerships we make with other countries in terms of whether it's giving them aid or whether it's giving them weapons or whether it's being signing defense treaties or trade agreements. We can't just, this idea that we can just pull everything back and at the same time, the United States maintains the same level of power and hegemony that it does in the world today. That's just, it can't exist. That's why, and it's not like, oh, everything will just go to like neutral. No, someone else will come in and fill the vacuum. Mm-hmm. That's why you have China building bases in Africa and South America and all of these other places, because they're trying to exert their influence in these places.
Right.
Right. And so, it's not like it just goes to zero and neutral. No, if the United States pull back, someone else will fill that power vacuum. That's just the way the world is, you know, and you don't have to like it, but this idea that, and first of all, this is what I'm getting on my people on the right. I love us. I do. But we are acting like the left. We're acting as if the issues we have in our country is because we don't have enough money or because of the system. And if we just gain more money, we can solve all our own problems. We don't have a money issue in the United States. We don't. Nobody looks at the United States and says, man, we really got a lack of money coming in, right? Or if you look at the budget for the United States, what we call defense spending and even foreign aid is such a small sliver of the budget. To focus on this doesn't even touch the deficit. If that's what our real, you know, concern is going to be, the national debt, you won't touch the national debt, then you're going to have to look at a lot more than national defense, which is like, you know, a small sliver of the pie. It sounds like a big number, but it really isn't.
The biggest part of our budget, quite frankly, is social programs.
And yes, it's entitlement. It's Social Security, Medicaid. Yeah, it's social programs.
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, and so they're focused on the wrong things in terms of if your concern is the national debt, $14 billion to Israel is a drop in the bucket. That's not even felt, right? And so, yeah, it's just not an educated position. It's just an emotional position. And so that is my issue with, you know, people that I normally agree with, is that they've approached this very irrationally and from an emotional standpoint and a very biased standpoint without thinking about what is the end result of this. I'll give an example. Years ago.
Okay, real quick. I got to do the rap.
Okay, go ahead.
No, go ahead with your example.
This is what I mean. It matters because a lot of this that the right is adopting is a lot of old libertarian type of thinking. So years ago, Ron Paul, when he's running for president, I liked him until he said one thing, and I realized he was completely ignorant on foreign policy. And this war right now is going to help you kind of understand why I was like, no, he's an idiot. Because he said, what's the big deal if Iran gets nuclear weapons? We have them. That is a completely ignorant statement. Like, and so put that today. Imagine if Iran had nuclear weapons today. So the fact that, and so it's just like this ignorance to the world and the way the real world actually works. And it's this ideology that is based in a libertarian isolationist type of thinking that isn't rooted in anything that's real. And so, yeah. And so yeah, you go ahead and wrap.
All right. Well, this has been a great conversation, Kevin. Thanks for doing this and coming on and kind of talking us through. There's a lot of other military related topics that I'd love to talk about with you about, at some point in the future, after you've made some life transitions, and we'll visit some more of those questions. But thanks for coming on and doing this. I think that there's been a lot of good interaction. People have really appreciated what you've shared. So thanks a lot, man. We really appreciate your help and your service. Oh, before you go, I want you to talk about Off-Code, because everywhere we go on the road, it is the most awesome podcast that nobody's ever heard of. And so talk about Off-Code. It's been part of your lower third there on the screen all evening. Yeah. What is it about?
Yeah, so Off-Code is a podcast that Monique and I co-host together, where we discuss issues of the Black community from a biblical worldview. And I say issues of the Black community, it is not just for the Black community. I mean, a lot of people listen to it, and it answers a lot of their questions and things they were thinking about, but didn't know how to ask the questions or even know. Sometimes people didn't know those things existed, and it's just very, very educational to them. And so, so we're in our third season. And it's really going great. I'm excited. We've added more episodes this year, so more frequent episodes. And check it out. If you haven't, if you're a Theology Mom fan and you haven't checked out Off-Code, yeah, check it out, because we actually have our own channel now. So if you just put Off-Code Podcast in YouTube or Spotify, Apple, wherever listen to podcasts, you can definitely find it.
Yes, go check it out. It is an extremely educational show, although it is focused on issues in the Black community. It's not just for Black people. It's for everybody. No. But Monique and Kevin bring a lot of perspective as cultural insiders and helping us think through some of the challenges, some of the celebrations, some of the humor in the Black community. And I love it. It is definitely one of my favorite podcasts. So thanks again, Kevin, for being here.
Absolutely. Anytime.
All right. God bless. Good night. Okay. As we round out the show here, I'm going to play a conversation that Monique and I had this morning about Title IX. A big update happened yesterday to Title IX, where something that historically has been just simply on the basis of sex, giving women access to things like sports and dormitories and educational institutions has now been redefined to include gender identity. We're going to talk briefly about it here. Here's the clip.
So we're going to talk about Title IX and the baloney. I'm at a conference, so I have to keep myself holy and righteous. Well, I should be doing that anyway, but still. Yes, so Title IX was, it wasn't even passed. It was signed in.
Department of Education yesterday amended Title IX, and it's been kind of in the works for a while, from what we understand. Done a little bit of preliminary research on it. I'm sure that people from like Alliance and Defending Freedom are going to be commenting soon. But we just wanted to do like a quick thing this morning while we were at a conference. I made some posts about it on social media last night and just wanted to talk about it really quickly.
So let's talk about what Title IX was before the changes came in. So Title IX was originally signed into law in the early 70s.
I think that's
it was you know, brought in through the Department of Education or into the Department of Education, really to be able to protect the spaces of girls and not just girls, but it protected it created safe spaces so that like a locker room or a sports team would be sex specific and sex safe, but it didn't just do that. It did so much more than
it was
that.
A lot of it was about equal opportunity or equal access for women, particularly carving out spaces for women's sports, and has kind of evolved over time into, like you were saying, the locker room issue and, you know, all of that. But it's really was a on the basis of sex, equal action, equal access and equal protection.
Yes. And so it was something that was needed, especially during a time when, you know, a woman may not be able to get that protection or that access. She might not be allowed into the school based on her sex, or she, you know, may not get dorm room access based on sex. And so there were a lot of inequalities, and Title IX came in to help offer protection against some of that discrimination.
So now what happened yesterday was, and you can go on the government website, just go on Google, type in Title IX, and you're going to see a lot of news stories about it, but you'll be able to see the main page. I think it's on the Department of Education page. And the big amendment was that now gender identity is falling under Title IX. And so gender identity can be any person who identifies as a female can now theoretically have equal access and equal protection for things that were formerly on the basis of sex. Now it's on the basis of sex and gender identity.
Yes. Yeah. And so many people are upset because what does this mean for my kid's locker room? What does this mean for my kid's softball team? What does this mean for the bathrooms? How do schools and administrators plan to protect, especially girls, when they are, you know, using the restroom or showering or, you know, wanting to participate in a female-only sports team? If a male who identifies as a female now decides that they want to join that team.
Another big issue is that sexual harassment or sexual discrimination will be dependent on gender identity as well. And so potentially the whole pronoun issue, you could have a kindergartner being reprimanded at school for sexual harassment if they don't use the proper pronouns.
Yes.
Because this will affect kindergarten through college.
And I was just about to say that this is a K through college situation. Title IX is K through. So it's not just, you know, in high school. It's not just in universities, but this is all the way through.
Yeah.
I mean, like we have seen some of this in regards to race with kids in lower grades being punished for very silly things and like making comments. For example, we had a situation where there was a 6-year-old in kindergarten. They were playing on the monkey bars rightfully so, one of the little boys says, well, hey,
you're, little kids do.
Yeah, you're a monkey. Look at you on the monkey bars. Unfortunately, this was a white kid to a black kid. The white kid got in trouble for, you know, calling him a monkey, and now it's racist. If we aren't, you know, careful and really having appropriate conversations with our kids, or, you know, what do you say with pronouns and things like that, your child runs the risk of, well, I called, he was a boy yesterday. I don't know.
And the pronouns are getting a little bit more crazy. Now, somebody was asking on the stream, what about private institutions? This applies to those institutions, kindergarten through college, who receive federal funds. And so let's say college scholarships through federal programs, it would impact those institutions, even if they're private. It would impact a school that maybe is receiving federal money for a lunch program for low-income students. But what I think, and this is something that we'll need like our friends at the Alliance of Defending Freedom to speak into, is religious institutions, religious schools. According to the document, on the document I read yesterday from the Department of Education, I'm pretty sure it allows for religious exemptions, but I'm sure that will also eventually be tested in the courts.
Yes, and there are specific organizations that are trying to usurp that right now. They are working in universities. They have plants in universities to be able to overturn a lot of that or to demand their rights. For example, you can look up Soul Force, S-O-U-L, Force, F-O-R-C-E, I believe it's .org. Or you can look up the REAP Project, the R-E-A-P Project. These are organizations that train and raise activist students to be able to go in and bring in queer ideology.
Into Christian
institutions, yes.
Now, we featured both of those on a podcast recently with our friends from the Religious Freedom Institute. I think that podcast was back in February. People can go back on all the things and see that podcast. It's called something about when the woke come to your church or something like that. But, you know, we're going to be tracking this and keep you informed. But we also did a podcast recently about what cost are you willing to pay for your job and counting that cost. And we really want Christians to be proactive. We want pastors to be thinking ahead of how they're going to support people in their congregation who work in public education. And, yes, the...
It won't come in and just say the change has not been.
Yeah,
it won't come in until I think August 1st.
Yeah, that's a good point. Is it, don't worry that like it's going to be implemented on Monday at your kid's school. It's not. It's August 1st. So be thinking ahead for the fall. But that's where we want Christians to be thinking ahead of, what cost am I willing to pay? If you're working in public education, you know, what are you going to do? And I think that it's important to be proactive, pastors, educators. And a lot of people are making comments of like, oh, I'm so glad I've already left public education. I'm so glad I'm not part of this.
I'm so glad I pulled my kids out.
Yeah. My challenge to you is, what would you say to those Christians who are still in public education? Because this is a federal law now that was not put into place by elected officials. It was put in by appointees in the Department of Education. And so what will we be doing to say a word of encouragement to those Christians who are still working in public education? If all this law, in my opinion, does seem designed to force whatever Christians remain in public education.
Definitely.
But if they all leave, where does that leave the children who are vulnerable?
Yes. And
that's my question.
I would even take that a step further and say that it's not just to get those Christian teachers or Christian leaders outside of the school. What they want to do is remove Christianity and the Christian voice from the public discourse or the public square overall. And I think this is just another step in that. What I think we missed or didn't pay enough attention to, and I was talking to you about this earlier today, is when a couple years ago that gay choir came out with this whole, we're coming for your kids. Hi, they're here. Like, you know.
And then they wanted to play it off as like, oh, it's just a spoof. Don't take it so seriously.
No.
but they're coming out of your kids. Out.
Yes. Another thing that I was thinking about is that this might be a little political, but, you know, the cowardly leaders will always sacrifice your children first. And this is what we're seeing in our nation is we have cowardly leadership and our children are the ones who are being sacrificed.
If all the Christians flee public education, and we have said repeatedly, like, this is a two-front war. For your kids in leaving the public school, like, we get it. Like, we want churches to mobilize more and more educational options, especially for those who are low-income and single-parent families. Churches need to be thinking more creatively about how children can exit the public school system. But it is not our position that all Christians should exit the public school yeah. system as adults. If you're working there, you can still be salt and light. So I want to challenge Christians to try to stick it out, but have a game plan in place of what you will do if you're a leader, if you're a principal, how are you going to fight back? You know, maybe you need to start tuning into the Alliance of Defending Freedom or the Pacific Justice Institute or these kinds of entities that offer legal help. Like, what can you do as a principal? What can you do as a teacher? Contacting our friends at Christian Educators, our friend David Schwiss, I'm going to be reaching out to him next week to see what they're doing on that front. And whatever I find out, we'll bring to you.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yes, it is. It's definitely a hard situation for, you know, Christian leaders to be in. I would say parents, make sure if your kid is in public school, have conversations with them. You know, what does it look like if they are now, you know, told, well, you need to be speaking or using my pronouns, whatever their pronouns are.
Yeah. Future is saying, you know, some Christians may feel like working in a public schools is their mission field. And that's so important. Like, we do not have the position of telling Christians all Christians should exit public schools. Our position is that might not be for our kids mission field, but for the adults, for those who are called into that space, be careful before opting out, because that salt and light could be important.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. What are the other comments?
Laura says we need to be praying for our friends serving in a public school system to stand firm against the schemes of the enemy. Somebody's, you know, talking about lawsuits. And I think, yeah, a lot of this will be arbitrated in the courts to try to be overturned.
I hope so. I mean, I guess a part of me really wishes or was looking for people's statements as soon as, you know, we knew that this was coming down the pike, or as soon as it was official and officially signed. Like, where was the church's, like, we disavow or we stand firmly against this or we will not comply? This is kind of where my heart was, is, you know, where are the statements? These mega churches who have, you know, all these kids who are in many of the public schools in their area. Where is your public stand and statement that says we will not comply? We do not support this.
Or that we will invest resources.
Yes.
That you're offering options for the kids in our congregation.
Yes.
I just don't see a lot of organized conversation in our church leadership of how are we going to help our congregants?
This is our time. Like, I feel like when the culture gets crazy, this is our time to shine. Like, oh, y'all got that new gender policy? Hey, because I got truth. I know what a human being is. I know how to define a human being. And so because I know how to define a human being, we're actually going to stay on the side of truth. But yeah, it just, I don't know. I have some concerns.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's just a quick thing about Title IX. I really appreciate the moderators putting a link to the Alliance of Defending Freedom press release that offers a good summary that you could send to people. Help your pastor be aware. I love Tanya's statement, you know, like, talk to your pastor about this. Let him know what's happening so that he can get a game plan together for how he's going to counsel his people who might be going through these issues. All right, friends, with that, we'll say good night. And we're going to mention the book one more time. Now available as a pre-order, Walking in Unity, Biblical Answers to Questions on Race and Racism, coming out October 15th. Please go pre-order it if you can. Please, please, please. Elisa Childers wrote the foreword on it. We have over 40 endorsements. We will be putting those on the website as the time gets closer. But super excited to let you know that it is now back up on Amazon. So with that, next week we are dark because both Monique and I will be out of town. And I believe that we will be back in 2 weeks. But make sure you're subscribed to the All the Things newsletter because that's the most up-to-date information. We've got some great shows planned for May and that you are not going to want to miss. So make sure you are signed up for the newsletter. With that, we will say have a good week. God bless and good night.
Thanks for listening to All the Things. Be sure to subscribe to our website at allthethingsshow.com and find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever you stream your podcast. Be sure to hit that subscribe button and the bell so you'll receive alerts when we post new shows. We'll see you next week.